Welcome back to the Electric Drum. I'm Juan Castillo. And, you know, I've been speaking with Darcy Cobbs Lomax, Executive Director of Project Access here in New Haven. It's a nonprofit organization that works with patients who are uninsured to get them specialists, right? And, you know, this is donated care that they find for these folks. So this is so, so important here in our community. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
All right, all right. So let's talk about, you know, you went to Florida State and we've been talking about that. You graduate.
I do.
So now it's the real world. What do you decide to do?
Well, in the fall of my senior year at Florida State, I was offered a job with a bank in Atlanta called Trust Company Bank. And this was in 1995, and it was just a different economy than today. Recruiters came to Florida State, it seemed like by the hundreds, to recruit graduates, but they were recruiting for jobs in the Southeast. So I had no options really to come back to Connecticut. So I said, well, I'll give Atlanta a shot. It seemed to be the place everybody was moving then. So yes. I accepted the job. I moved to Atlanta. I went through their corporate lending training program. And they basically teach you how to lend large sums of money to their clients. So I landed a spot in their agribusiness division, which was very much out of my element. And agribusiness is essentially making loans to the farming community, the agricultural businesses. So like Purdue Farms, I've been to pork processing plants, chicken processing plants, tobacco farms, very much not Bridgeport by any means. Yeah. So I did that for about 18 months. And then I realized it wasn't really what I felt most comfortable doing. And I took a position as a senior corporate credit analyst. So I was now back in the office and not traveling to small towns in Alabama and Tennessee to visit my clients, and just did credit analysis work for those companies instead. And I realized that I didn't hate my job, but I didn't love it. I wanted to do work that was meaningful to me, not just to the shareholders. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I thought, well, I'll go back to school. It's what I'm good at. I like it. And truthfully, at 20, I guess I was 22 or 23 then, it was sort of just the break I needed. Like I needed to just figure things out. So I applied to business school. It was practical. It was, I think, what my parents kind of urged me to do. And I'd learned a lot about business from working in a bank. And the College of Business for Georgia State was right across the street from my office. So I applied to Florida State and Georgia State. Both accepted me, but Georgia State, I was living in Atlanta. So I said, well, I'll give Georgia State a shot. And at that time, their part-time program was ranked number 2 in the country. So I thought, you know, good school in a city I love. I went back to school. And so that program was about 2 years. My concentration was personnel and employment relations. And I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed learning about people, the humanistic side of business, what motivates employees, why people come to work, why they don't work. Learned a lot about the legal side of business and hiring people, terminating people. And it was a great program. And it was, I think, the 2 years I needed to really kind of assess what I wanted to do in life.
Right.
Yeah.
So you get your master's and then what?
So I finished my MBA in December of 1999. And at that point, I'm looking to move back to the Northeast.
Okay.
And the economy's changing. The jobs aren't just falling out of the sky like they were in 1995. And I had a tough time, you know, finding a job here. When you live in the Southeast and you graduate from Georgia State, Emory, Florida State, they're like the Ivy Leagues of the South. Everyone knows those schools and they have great reputations. But coming to the Northeast with state school education from the South is a little different. You know, no one knows the program. No one knew that my program was ranked number 2 in the country for part-time programs here in Connecticut when you have, you know, Yale and Harvard and UConn and other top schools. But I ultimately landed a job with the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation at a small clinic in the South Bronx called Morrisania Diagnostic and Treatment Center. And I was hired there to work with their WIC program, their Women, Infants, and Children's program, as an interpreter. So here I am, I have an MBA, and here comes the French degree that no one ever thought would amount to much. And when I really needed a job, it's the job I was able to get. So
a lot of Haitians in New York City.
Haitians and a lot of immigrants from West Africa
Yes.
is mostly the population that I worked with.
Right.
So I moved back up here. I'm commuting from Bridgeport to New York because I thought other people do it, I can do it too. I'm young, that kind of thing. So, and it was an interesting job. It was never, I never thought about healthcare. And it was an eye-opening experience to how healthcare is delivered based on place. Where you live matters, where you're from matters in healthcare, how much money you have matters, your insurance status matters. And I learned all of that in this very small clinic. So I grew up with health insurance, or parents who had commercial insurance through their employer. When I got sick, we went to the doctor. I was amazed to see in this clinic women who would come with their children and wait for hours upon hours to see a provider. And I couldn't quite figure out why that was. As an interpreter working with nutritionists and with the breastfeeding counselor, you know, I would often learn the individual stories of how they came to this country, the difficult circumstances that they lived under, the illnesses that they had, their inability to access care. A lot of all of that just comes out in conversation. And it really got me to thinking about the injustices, if you will, you know, for certain people in this country.
Because we're talking about, like, I mean, a basic, you know, a basic right to some degree, right?
Mm-hmm.
That if I'm sick, right, it shouldn't matter how much money I make.
That's
because
correct.
I need to get better.
That's
right?
correct.
So you saw folks that couldn't get better because they didn't have enough money.
That's correct. And not so much always money, but there's so many social issues that affect how someone can access healthcare. So do you have transportation? We talked about walking, which is fine if you're well, if you're a young person, able-bodied, or you can ride a bike. But if you're not well, how easily can you get to a provider? If you don't speak the language, that's huge in America. The community that I was in was largely Spanish-speaking, but there was a small French-speaking population. But there's certainly more Spanish spoken in the South Bronx where I was than English or French. So language matters.
You learn some Spanish?
I know a little.
Enough to be able to get,
by a little bit.
Right.
One of the things I would do is I would sit in the waiting room of the clinic upstairs. And if a mom had a baby, I would share with them information on the WIC program downstairs. And I could go up at 9 o'clock and see who was there, and 11 o'clock and see some of the same faces and more. 2 o'clock, you might see some of the 11 o'clock faces. Like, the process didn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Yes.
And I was in a grant-funded position, funded by the state of New York, which the money was actually dwindling and running out for my position. So I said, well, I want to know the business behind hospitals and why they function this way, and or at least why this health system functions this way. And I was offered a job at Harlem Hospital, which is the partner hospital to this clinic. And I went to work in their infectious disease clinic, which was another grant-funded program. But I wanted to know the business behind healthcare in a way that I didn't learn in graduate school or didn't learn working at the small clinic. And one thing I learned, when your hospital has a $100 million deficit, as Harlem Hospital did at the time, that insurance status matters and billing matters, and matters in a way sometimes that it can almost overshadow patient care when the hospital's trying to get out of debt. So I learned a lot more than I ever thought I would about Medicaid, Medicare billing in the infectious disease world. And hospitals are businesses. They are. They are trying to provide good care and keep patients healthy, but they also have to, they need dollars to keep their doors open too.
This is Juan Castillo. I'm speaking with Darcy Cobbs Lomax, Executive Director of Project Access of New Haven here in New Haven, and we're going to talk about a program in a little while. But right now, we're talking about you know, how she got to that program, and she's, you know, talking about working now at Harlem Hospital, you know, on a grant program and dealing with infectious diseases and their patients. So let me ask this question. I mean.
Sure.
You know, during the time when we're talking about, you know, Obamacare, Affordable, you know, Act, and, you know, there were all these, you know, conversations about, you know, healthcare companies, hospitals, doctors. I mean, you know, when you're growing up, it's like, you know, become a doctor, you know, because you make a lot of money. You know, become a lawyer, you can make a lot of money, right? You know, so that's like the all-American dream, so to speak, right? You know, but by the same token, right, you know, during that period of time, folks mm-hmm. were talking about, well, you know, well, why do doctors have to be paid so much money mm-hmm. in order to be able to live like that, right? Mm-hmm. Not that all doctors, sure. you know, have yachts and so mm-hmm. forth and so on, but by the same token, you know, for you to tell me right now, it's like, okay, a hospital is $100 million in the red, right? Mm-hmm. You know, is that because of the high cost of salaries in the healthcare industry? What's the story, you know?
Well, I can't speak for all of Harlem Hospital.
Of course.
I think a lot of it has, that's a different hospital system than what we have in Connecticut. So it's a heavily unionized environment. Mm-hmm. It's a city hospital, part of the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation. So it's a small subset of many hospitals together. You know, hospital reimbursement for Medicaid and Medicare is not what it is for commercial insurance. So in a poorer community such as Harlem, a hospital may get 30 cents on the dollar of what a Mount Sinai may get 70 cents on the dollar for commercial insurance. So insurance reimbursement rates, I learned a lot about at Harlem Hospital, and you know, having efficient systems to make sure that billing happens properly so hospitals can get reimbursed. Laws change regularly in some states, in particular in New York. So what you may have been able to bill for as part of a patient's care 1 year may have changed the next year. And did that trickle down to the right person to adjust the billing? So there's a number of things that go into hospital deficits.
Wow.
And within hospital systems, there are areas that make money and areas that lose money. And oftentimes, primary care centers tend to be those that don't bring in big bucks for hospitals.
So you're talking about rich neighborhoods versus poor neighborhoods.
Right? To some degree,
that's
yes.
That's crazy. So, okay, so you learned a lot about that, right, mm-hmm. while you were there. And so after that, where do you go?
So I was commuting, as I mentioned, from Bridgeport to New York every day, and
yes.
It just got hard. I had my oldest son, I think was about 2 at the time. He's mm-hmm. going to be 15 next month. So I reached out to a dear friend of mine, Dory Dumas here, who I'm
Big
sure you know.
Dory.
She is
yeah.
my soror, and and I don't even think she really knows that she's that instrumental in my career starting in New Haven. But
okay.
I mentioned to her that I was looking to do some work in Connecticut in public health. And she connected me with a gentleman named Jim Rawlings
yes.
from Yale New Haven, who now is retired. And I landed a job at the New Haven Health Department managing their asthma program. That was also grant funded. So as you'll hear through my story, public health jobs tend to be funded with soft dollars. So.
Mm.
So I was at the health department for about a year, really kind of learning New Haven. Now, I was hopeful to land a job in Bridgeport, my hometown, but it didn't work out that way. And so I worked with the health department for about a year managing at the asthma initiative for the city in schools and in communities.
I grew up with asthma. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. Talk about your experience working in that particular job and how asthma affects our community.
So asthma affects the affects people of color and at disproportionate rates to
Wow.
other ethnic groups.
Why is that?
Well, there's a number of reasons. So air quality matters, where you live matters. So if you live in a community that perhaps has poor air quality, New Haven has in the past been, you know, reports have shown that air quality here is not the best, not the worst in the country, but not the best. Your living conditions, if you have issues of moisture or mold or dust mites or things that can trigger asthma episodes, those tend to surround people who live in areas of poverty. New Haven has a fairly high poverty rate. People of color in New Haven live in below the poverty, children of color in New Haven live below the poverty level at higher rates than Caucasian children. So someone can have asthma that's controlled. But what I was finding in my job was that we had asthma, children with asthma where it wasn't controlled, where they had high hospital emergency room visits and admissions. So, and that was something we were trying to work towards fixing,
if
you will.
And that was because they didn't have the kind of health care coverage to be able to control the asthma?
Well, to some degree. Well, a lot of it's environmental. So if you live in an apartment and let's say you're renting and let's say there's a mold problem, but you can't really get your landlord to fix it. Or maybe you don't know you have mold in your walls. Or maybe the parents aren't as well educated on how to control the child's asthma. Or maybe they don't have the proper equipment to give asthma treatment at home or at school. So part of it was making sure that patients had, if they needed a nebulizer, that they had that available to them in the schools. If they needed specific equipment that the school didn't have, we provided air conditioners to help with temperature in individuals' homes, green cleaning products. What you clean your house with matters when you have asthma.
Wow.
You know, certain chemicals can, when you don't have asthma and you clean with certain chemicals, you know, you can breathe them in and think, wow, that's pretty strong. So if you are someone who is asthmatic, you know, what you clean with can matter. So we had a grant at the time that helped to support that program, which ultimately kind of dwindled down a little bit. I know there is an asthma program today, but I was coming near the end of my funding, and I thought, well, I've got to look for another job.
So it's interesting, you know, because you mentioned the word soft dollars earlier, and like that keeps coming up over and over and over again.
Sure.
It's like all of these programs that are so important in our community are not part of budgets. They're basically grants and just they run out. Is that what you found?
It is.
It's interesting.
It's interesting. You know, statistically, depending upon how you look at it, Connecticut's a fairly healthy state in comparison to other states. Like when you look at obesity rates or infant mortality, Connecticut's not among the least healthy states in the country. So you'll find that states and communities proportion funding to where there's the biggest need. So while there are needs around public health concerns in New Haven or Bridgeport or Hartford, Waterbury, or in Connecticut in general, oftentimes funds maybe aren't given to those communities at the same rate that you might find in a comparable state.
Wow.
So, and I don't think it's any secret to those of us who work in public health that our jobs tend to be grant funded. And you hope you can keep your funding. You hope you can, you know, continue to move programs forward. And sometimes you can and sometimes you cannot.
So you moved from that job to what?
So I was invited at that time by Mayor John DeStefano to join his staff. I took the position of Director of Elderly Services for the city of New Haven, which was very much more human services than public health. What I really loved about that job was being out in the community. This is where I really got to know New Haven, how to get around, what was where, who was who. I spent a lot of time at the senior centers that the city operated, really listening to the voice of older adults in New Haven and what their needs were, what they had seen from the city, what they liked about the city, what they didn't like, what they thought the city should be doing for them. Medicare Part D rolled out during this time for the first time. And so I learned far more about Medicare than I ever thought I would. I became kind of the go-to person in my family for lots of questions from older adults about Medicare. And that was a really interesting job from the human services perspective. It also was my first time being a manager or director in a unionized environment. So things I'd learned about in school that, you know, I just never had to really deal with, come up when you work in municipal government. And I have to say it was a little more political than I actually anticipated.
Right.
You know, older adults vote. So their opinion matters. What the city does for them matters. What they want matters. And they like their voices heard. And there are the population I worked with is a population that calls City Hall, called me a lot, writes lots of letters, I'm sure still does. But they were just a real loving group that really embraced me. I was in my early 30s then. So, you know, here comes this young person to address the needs of retirees or people who are 65 or older. And I'm not from New Haven, and that matters to some people here. I found they said, you're from Bridgeport. What do you know about New Haven? And, you know, very different city, but very much the same in many ways. And I think what I will say about myself is I had the heart for the work. So not being from New Haven didn't matter so much because I cared about the people I worked with.
So all those jobs prepare you for what you're doing now.
That's correct.
Let's talk about Project Access of New Haven.
Yeah. So I came to Project Access in May of 2012. And Project Access was founded in 2009 by a group of community doctors who wanted to address the unmet needs of the uninsured. So if you have no insurance, you can get primary care, probably not easily, but you can be seen At a federally qualified health center in town, so Fairhaven Community Health Center or Cornell Scott Hill, the Yale Primary Care Center can see you, but you'll be put on a sliding scale. So you'll pay something if you have the ability to pay. So you can get a physical. You know, if you've got a rash, you can go in and say, "I've got, you know, this rash on my arm. What do you think?" If you need to see a specialist, that's where it becomes very difficult. So what these doctors were finding was that most doctors want to help. They will see an uninsured patient. But when you need other services, such as if you need an x-ray or if you need some labs or some sort of pathology or imaging, they then would resort to what one of our physicians calls begging. You know, he's a cardiologist and he'll say, you know, I would have to beg, you know, a radiologist or someone to look at images for me because they didn't have anyone to do that piece for free.
Right.
So this group got together and said, well, there's got to be a solution or a way to manage this. And they looked to a Project Access site that was started in Asheville, North Carolina in 1996. So Project Access is not unique to New Haven. There's about 150 Project Access sites across the United States. And our model is to take individuals who need to see specialists and connect them in care. This group recruited their friends and colleagues at community practices to volunteer to see patients. So when a provider signs up with Project Access, they say, well, I'll see one patient a month, or maybe I'll see five patients a month. And since 2009, we saw actually our first patient the fall of 2010. So this is prior to my arrival at Project Access. We have coordinated the care and provided patient navigation for more than 1,000 patients. And the value of that donated care is in excess of $20 million
wow.
today. And the crux of what we do is patient navigation. So I have a staff of five patient navigators who work with the patients to make sure that they not only have their medical appointments scheduled, but if there's any ancillary services that are needed, if they need labs done, if they need imaging, that all of that happens and that that paperwork gets to the specialist's office. If they need help with interpreting, about 70% of our patients are Spanish-speaking, so all of the staff is bilingual English-Spanish in my office. I haven't gotten to use my French too much just yet. I'm waiting for the day that a patient walks through the door and maybe needs some assistance. So they also help them address social determinants of health. So if they have issues of food insecurity, where is a food pantry that we can help them get connected to? Housing is big for our clients. Housing's tough in New Haven in general.
Yeah.
So if you are low income, working under the table, uninsured, you know, it's even harder sometimes. So we do the best we can. Housing
you deal
is,
with mental health folks too?
So we don't.
You don't.
We
wow.
do. So, and there's a couple of reasons why we work with patients who have an episode of care. So there's a start and a stop.
Yes.
So we may get a patient who is seen at Fairhaven Clinic for belly pain and it's decided they need to see a GI doctor. So
yes.
The referral comes to us. Our nurse looks at it. We decide it's clinically urgent. We get them connected to a GI doctor who then may decide, well, the patient needs their gallbladder out.
Mm.
Yale New Haven Hospital donates the operating space, the operating room space for that, any anesthesia, any other pathology or any other testing that's needed. And the surgeon, who may be a Yale doctor or a community doctor, will perform the surgery for the patient. There is no charge to the patient for the care. Afterwards, there is a follow-up period. So if the provider says, I want to see the patient at 2 months, 6 months, and 9 months, we will continue to follow the patient and make sure we speak to him or her once a month and check in and how are you doing, make sure they get to those follow-up appointments on time. And it's really a lot of trust building and support that we give to the patient. As a result, our no-show rate hovers around 3-4% for appointments, which is almost unheard of in healthcare.
So this is mostly referral-driven?
It is 100% referral-driven.
Okay.
So you cannot self-refer. However, we do get patients who call us who say, you know, I'm sick or I have this going on. And what we'll say is, you know, who's your primary care provider? If they don't have one, we'll try to, you know, refer them to one of the FQHCs in town.
Right.
And we, both Fairhaven and Cornell Scott Hill know us very well.
Mm.
So when they have an uninsured patient, their referrals coordinator, you know, knows who to send to us if they need to see a specialist. We have pretty much every specialty covered from GI, cardiology, oncology, urology, neurology. I mean, we've got pretty much all of them covered. Some areas we have more specialists than others to choose from, but just by virtue of you know, great physicians in this community, and you know, the what used to be two hospitals and now one, we are able to really make a difference in these patients' lives.
So, obviously, the doctors, you know, are providing, you know, the donations, and some of the hospitals. So, how do you stay alive, though? Any foundations, anyone that's helping you with that?
Good question. Again, we are funded through primarily through grant dollars. So Yale New Haven Hospital supports us with dollars. The Ecumenical Free Bed Fund of the hospital, the State of Connecticut Department of Public Health, the Community Foundation, New Alliance Foundation, Webster Bank, Connecticut State Medical Society, and individual donors as well. The hospital donates our space to us for free, so we don't pay rent for our space. Metro Taxi is a key partner of ours.
Wow.
So when we have patients who need assistance with transportation, if the navigator can't help them figure out the bus or someone to drive them, Metro Taxi supports us with free taxi rides for patients. They tend to be our last resort because we try not to abuse that partnership, but they've been very generous. We've had two patients who were amputees, and Yale Surgical has provided the prosthesis for those patients, which, you know, the out-of-pocket cost could be in the thousands or tens of thousands to have a prosthesis made and properly fit and the physical therapy. Quinnipiac University, the new medical school there, does imaging for us on Fridays. Also, their School of Physical Therapy does physical therapy for our patients as well. So we've got a lot of key partners that really support
that's
our work
awesome.
And have helped to keep things moving.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, and I keep hearing the Community Foundation over and over again every time I all these interviews. And that's great. You know, I think that, you know, your program is doing wonderful things. And, you know, hopefully, you know, we can get some real dollars, right? You know, the soft dollars again that keeps popping up.
Yeah.
But that's fantastic. So, well, thank you for coming. But
you're
before
welcome.
You leave, you know, give and go, right?
Mm-hmm.
You
yes.
know, you listen to the show. So
that's right.
Yeah, so first question, what's your favorite movie?
Mm.
You know, there's a good one out now, Concussion, that probably, you know, you're probably going to go see, right?
Well, maybe. My favorite movie is Coming to America.
Oh, really?
That is
great
one
movie.
Of my favorite.
Great
that
movie.
And The Wiz. Great. I just watched The Wiz from 1978 with my kids recently, and we just love that.
Well, that's awesome. Uh-huh. That's awesome. So, you know, you from Bridgeport, then, you know, the South and all of that. What's your favorite food?
Macaroni and cheese, but I have a good friend, Jamie Jeter, who makes it, and she's giving me her recipe. I haven't quite matched it, but mac and cheese.
All right. So what's the best advice you ever gotten from who?
So when my mom left me at Florida State, or not left me, but dropped me off at college, she
yes.
gave me a card. And in there it said, stand up for what you believe is right, even if it means standing alone.
Wow.
And I remember that to this day, almost 25 years later.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Well, you've inspired me. I hope the community has been inspired by your story. You know, you have four kids, you said, right?
That's correct. I do.
So,
yes. Yes, sir.
So I know that's tough, right? You know,
we manage, you know, my husband
go.
Works in healthcare also, and he
great.
Works nights. I work days and we make it work.
Well, big ups to him. Let's give him a shout out.
Yes,
right?
That's right.
And thank you so much for coming again.
You're welcome.
All right. Juan Castillo, which has been the Electric Drum. We will see you next week.